car enthusiasts and the people who love them.
Hello, welcome back. This is The Thing About Cars, recording as always at Strongbox West in Atlanta. Today, we have around the table...
Becca.
Andrew.
Ben.
And I'm Mickey. And we're going to do listener questions today. We've solicited questions online via our Facebook page and our website. And we actually have a list of things that I think we should address from our friends out in the listening world. The first question is from our friend Mike Esser. Mike asks, is a Toyota MR2 from the 2000 to 2005 era with a swapped 2ZZ engine a poor man's Elise? Will the engine swap give that much more power? Is there any way to get more low end, like maybe adding a turbo? That's what Mike has to ask, and I'm going to throw that out there. I know Ben has done a little of the homework here and probably has a lot to say about being a poor man's Elise. Ben, what do you think?
Well, I would say, not to be too big a spoiler, but I'd say the short answer is yes. And this really kind of shocked me. This is something I'd heard of. You know, being a Lotus enthusiast, I've heard about a lot of these kind of things. But when I dug a little deeper on it, some things I found were very interesting. This is the generation of MR2 that often referred to as the Spider, the cute little convertible one. They didn't sell well in the United States, so it's the most recent MR2 we got. It's less than 200 pounds heavier than an Elise. So there's not a big weight difference. The 2ZZ, or ZZ if you're Canadian, that's the engine that is used in the Elise. It's 40 more horsepower than the 1ZZ that the MR2 Spider comes with.
So it does compare. It is the poor man's Elise.
Yeah, well, it's more than just the power. It's also the chassis. Because the MR2 is actually pretty good in the handling department. And of course, there are probably some bits you can get that'll improve it even more. It's certainly going to fit big, obnoxiously tall people like us better than the Elise. I actually sat in an Elise yesterday and demonstrated how ridiculously hilarious it is for a person my size to get in and out of one.
Right.
It's really something. But the Toyota is going to fit just about everybody, probably a little more comfortable. It's also, because it's a Toyota, you can get the bits everywhere.
Everywhere.
You can fix it easily, cheaply, and... it's a full convertible, while the Elise is just a target top.
So what is a 2ZZ engine?
Well, it's a double overhead cam 4 made by Toyota, designed by Yamaha.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't know a whole lot of specifics, but I know that it uses some sort of variable valve timing setup.
Okay.
Now, as far as producing more bottom end, that I don't know that much about. I don't know that it's particularly lacking in that department, but a turbo to me seems kind of the antithesis. That's going to give you high end.
Sure.
So I'm really not sure, but maybe a different chip programming or something will help it a little. But I've never driven either an Elise or an MR2 Spider or one with that engine in it, so
right.
I really can't comment on the performance. But after reading all this, it sounds so good. And Elises right now you'd be lucky to find one under $30,000. And this is a car that hasn't been sold in the United States in 10 years.
Yeah.
Of course, the MR2 goes even further back. I mean, 05, I believe you said, was the cutoff on that. But
They're
out there. You can find them if you want them. So I would totally go for it if I was interested in that sort of thing.
My friend has an older version, an older generation of the MR2.
Right.
The one that preceded the Spider.
Yeah.
And he loves that car. And
sure.
I have driven it. And it is actually a really finely engineered car.
Oh, yeah.
Toyota put a lot of good thought into that thing.
They were good.
Yeah. But so, okay, we'll have to tell Mike. Mike, if you're listening, you should definitely... do the swap and take some pictures of it and go.
After doing the homework, I was starting to say, well, can I make a little more room in the garage?
Yeah, I mean, how much is that generation MR2 going for these days?
I didn't look that up, but I would think, maybe some well-sorted ones might have a little bit of a premium because there are some people who know about them.
Right.
One of the things I have with me actually mentions the price range of the MR2.
Because you're looking for one without an engine.
Okay, this one's saying 1985 to 1989.
Different generation completely.
Yeah. So, but it's $10,500 to $14,000 for... this group.
For that generation.
Yeah.
But these are in better condition. They have their engines are not.
Right, right. If that's from 85, that's the first generation MR2, which is a bit collectible.
Right.
I wanted one so hard when I was in high school.
And also you were talking about how the Spider didn't really sell well. So
yeah.
That is actually going to kind of not help you find one though.
Right.
Because if
it
didn't sell that well, you have a scarcity almost.
Yeah.
If
you got one. You may have to wait and be patient, but it'll turn up sooner or later.
Yep.
All right.
I wonder if the prior I wonder if the engine will fit in the prior generation MR2.
Because I would really think so. I really would think so, yeah.
Well, you said it's a double overhead cam 4. I mean, that's like Toyota's specialty right there. Right. It should be able to fit into anything, really.
Yeah.
Without having to re-engineer the mounts or anything like that too heavily.
No, I wouldn't think.
I don't know about that part. I don't really modify cars, but I would assume.
Huh. Yeah.
All right, next question. This question comes from our good friend, buddy, and brother, Flip.
Right.
So Flip has a question about cup holders in cars. He writes, I had a Saturn that seated two people in the front and three in the back if they were small and or really liked each other. It had a grand total of 4 accessible cup holders in the front and only 2 in the back. What's up with that?
I'm wondering how he got 4 in the front. Half the time, I'm happy if I have 1 cup holder up front.
I think on the Saturns, if it was a sedan like what he's talking about, then you would have 2 in the center console and then 1 in each door, if I remember right.
This was a metallic green 1999 SL1, if I recall correctly. This is my brother's car. I've been in it. the ones in the doors, I don't know if... because the ones in doors, I think, are kind of more designed for water bottles. And the reason there's a semantic difference is you have to tip whatever goes into them quite a bit to get them in and out of those door pockets.
Yeah, I don't think those count as actual cup holders. I think
bottle holders.
Bottle holders.
Yeah, whereas the ones in the center console, vertical in and out, and they're right there. The door ones, you have to kind of reach down. You've got to tip them a little bit. And because of that tipping, sometimes only a fairly narrow container will go in them in some cars.
And then I guess the 2 in the back are the ones that flip out the back of the console in that model.
Probably, am I correct
on that one? Or maybe they're in that flip-down arm.
I don't remember.
Style.
I was never in the back seat.
I'm thinking of the Pontiac that I have. It's similar. It's got the 2 in the center console. It's got the 2 in the doors.
Yeah.
And then in the back seat, which is a much bigger back seat, you don't have to love each other quite as much to have 3 people.
Right.
But it's got that flip-down. It's bigger than an armrest. It's
a whole
seat section flips down, and then you've got a flat area and 2 2 cup holders. I guess you put the third person in the trunk, and then they don't
they don't get to drink at all.
No.
I know in my Mazda, the ones in the doors are really kind of water bottle holders because I've got a kind of a skinny 24-ounce bicycle bottle, and that's about the biggest thing that'll go in those. And even then, it's in at kind of an angle, and
so
kind of.
Flip's answer is those aren't cup holders.
Technically speaking, I would say no.
They're not cup holders. That's it. So, what was that? I was reading some time ago that cup holders are actually a major marketing feature for women in cars?
Cadillac said as much in an ad a few years ago. They didn't really say women, but they had a...
that to me.
Yeah, they had know that either.
Well,
Please explain.
They had a good-looking model driving one of their cars, and she says, you know what sells cars? She had a sexy Italian or some kind of accent. It's not the horsepower. It's not the torque. It's cup holders.
No, it's the women with big boobs in the commercials. But
I don't remember if they...
I mean,
how do we know that she had big boobs? I don't remember.
I'm making the assumption.
They just kind of showed her face for the most part.
No, I have never, ever in my life not heard a man nor a woman look at a car and go, man, look at those cup holders.
Right.
Never heard that.
I mean, they're good to have.
Yeah.
But
I definitely think a premium is necessary. Like, I can't remember if it's the brand new or the last generation Dodge Ram that had like 3 across the center console, even though you couldn't get 3 people in that front seat.
Right.
And I think what it's come down to is people use cup holders for so much more than just cups today.
Yeah. Well, the fact that it's in a Ram, one of those is going to be the driver's spit cup.
I said it was a newer one, so
no,
maybe not.
To Ram driver.
No, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that.
No, I mean,
it just came into my head,
Well,
pickup
trucks. It could be other things. If you've got, if it's a work truck and you're trying to work, if you've got a little cup in there that you've got full of pens and pencils.
Yes.
But maybe that's not the best thing.
And
those visors are for. But
a lot of cup holders make good phone holders, and some of those cup holders have pretty good acoustics for when you're using your phone for GPS.
That's true, too.
It is true, actually. There is some truth to that. All right. So there is an NPR article that I'm not going to read. I'm going to let everybody pick it up later, and we can discuss it next time if you want. But the article is titled, Men Are From Mars, Women Love Cup Holders? And it's by Linda Holmes wrote this thing. And it's obviously about quite a bit more than cup holders. But, to have a look at that article, and we can discuss that some other time.
Are we talking about bra cups, maybe?
No. No, it's there's a picture of a center console in this article. Men are from Mars, women, .. love cup holders,
Inappropriate jokes about what you could put in them then.
And somebody had heated and cooled cup holders in their car. I can't remember who that was.
I think that was actually Mopar.
Was it? Okay.
Who did that? I can't remember, though.
I thought it was Cadillac, but...
That is something Cadillac would do.
Yeah.
You're right.
It could be
but better. I don't know. But you're right. The heated and cooled cup holders.
Right. All right.
I'm rolling my eyes. Can't hear it.
The next question we have for our listener listener questions episode is from our friend Kathy. Kathy Poley asks, what is the best way to learn about basic car maintenance if you know nothing about automobiles? Andrew.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to take this one because I was in that position. I don't have any mechanics in my family or anything like that, and I actually just went to school for it. I went to Gwinnett Tech. It was very affordable, and they take you from not knowing ratchets and wrenches to, you know, I've become a certified technician today because of it.
So
but
you
if
don't have to have any knowledge of even basic tools
they,
to walk in.
They go over, this is a toolbox, this is a flathead, this is a Phillip head. They take it down.
Oh,
you could be completely know nothing about cars whatsoever, and they will turn you into a good technician.
Or a screwdriver. Oh,
well, to take that down a notch, what if you just want to learn to DIY your own car? Would you do that?
With that in mind, if it's not going to be your career choice, then No, I definitely wouldn't recommend that because you're also paying to go to college for
right.
it. And if you're not looking to do that, I really think there's a lack of good knowledge out there. But it's not that it's inaccessible because you can find people on YouTube, like my YouTube channel,
yeah.
who teach to do lots of things. But I think that there's not so many people out there who are willing to take somebody in and go, this is how you do this, and actually show
right.
them in person how to do that.
Because my thought was find a good mentor. In my case, it was my dad.
Right. Well, if you don't have that, for instance, my dad is not a mechanic himself.
Exactly.
So I didn't have that option. Yeah. And that's the only way I was able to figure it out. But because of that, I've actually tried to become that person who will teach new people. And
Excellent.
That goes back into me taking those interns in and teaching them things so that they can be better technicians of tomorrow.
Right.
And I think that would be the way to do it. If you can find somebody to mentor you, do it. If you can't, a technical school, Athens Tech, Gwinnett Tech, any of these places, you can get into a program.
I mean, heck, you know, I'm not as good as you guys are, but if anyone ever asks me a car question, I'll dive into it with them, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I think for the amateur, the internet is your friend. Find an enthusiast group to get in with.
Find an enthusiast group or just hang with a friend and say,
right.
hey, look, I have a question about this. Can you help me do this kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I mean,
and nothing,
I can be bought with a lot of pizza and beer, so.
And nothing beats the hand-on experience, though. When we talk about the internet, yeah, it's a great place to learn how to do things
right.
because you can learn so much, but actually getting the experience is hard to do.
Yeah. Right.
But if it's, you know, if people are like me, they don't want to just know how do you do the process of this? Why does it work this way?
Right.
So
it's good. Well, it's a good tool, too, for finding those other. Yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Just
yeah. Like you may not learn how to do the job, but you might find online getting in touch with the person who can take you one-on-one and say, look, here's how you do it. You
know? Well, I don't want to just know how to do something.
Right,
I want to know why it's done that way so that I can better understand and
Absolutely.
Just grow with that.
But
How Stuff Works has an entire section for cars, just automotive.
That's HowStuffWorks.com?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
Dynamite.
It will give you the, what do you want to call them? The moving graphic illustrations that will show you, okay, here's the inside of a internal combustion engine. Here's what it looks like when the pistons go up and down. And it helps you really visualize something.
Sure.
If you don't know how it works and you can see, here's why oil is so important.
Let me make sure we're being comprehensive for Kathy's purposes here, because all four of us are people who are not afraid to break things open and see how they work.
That's how we earn our living here at the table.
So, but in Kathy's case, and she's not alone, there are tons of people out there who are just daunted, find the whole prospect of doing car maintenance kind of daunting. You know, what if you screw things up beyond your own ability to fix them?
And that's kind of what I was talking about too, is if you get in your driveway and you're looking on the internet how to do something, and then you get on your car and you find out that there's two different ways to do brakes on Toyota because they did two different calipers that year and you got the wrong one, and now you can't find a video and your car's apart and now it won't go back together.
Yeah.
That's the situation you want to avoid.
And I find
that too.
A lot of those online instructions are not so much good for the uninitiated as much as if you have a basic skill set, they give you a roadmap for how to use that skill set in unfamiliar territory.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, there's that natural inquisitiveness, but I would say that if you're sort of, I'm going to use the word afraid of getting your hands dirty and taking things apart, then like we've said before, just call up a friend who's not and have a good time together.
Yeah.
Right. And I would say definitely that when you start, obviously don't start doing a head gasket. Start with something like brakes or oil or things like this that are much easier than the head gasket daunting task.
And if you have an enthusiast angle, like I mentioned before, there's some particular car you gravitate toward, find a bunch of people who are doing a tech day.
Yes.
You know, like, a whole bunch of Camaro enthusiasts, you know, getting together to help each other, you know, do stuff.
Yeah. And then one of the things I did when I was getting into vehicles and automotive school is that the truck I mentioned in an earlier episode, I actually bought that as a project to learn on so that it wasn't my daily driver I was going to screw up. It was this truck that if I screw it up, I can still get to work tomorrow. Exactly. I'm not totally stranded. And that was probably the best learning experience ever, is having something that I completely had to rebuild. You know, that teaches you a lot. A lot of hard way lessons, though, but you get there.
You mentioned Tech Day, Ben, and I'm like, we should do a Tech Day.
Yeah, we totally could.
We'll put that idea on the shelf and definitely take a look at that. Next question. My friend Eric Benjamin says, what is the perfect first car for a teenager with a $2,000 budget, airbag and ABS, and hopefully cigar smells included, preferably a sedan? So what would that car be for Eric's teen?
Ooh, Camry, hands down. The 90s to early 2000s Camrys with the 2.2 liters that you just can't kill. You get good gas mileage. It's a big size car, and you get reliability and cheap parts.
The Tercel?
The Tercel, I don't know how familiar the audience is with YouTube, but if you go to Scotty Kilmer, he's a very famous mechanic on YouTube.
Yes.
He'll tell you the Tercel was the turd cell of Toyotas, that they weren't actually their finest hour. And I have not had that experience, though. I have customers with Tercels that have really high mileage on them, but there's kind of a mixed bag with that. Some people hate them, some people love them. I've never met anyone who said, wow, my 99 Camry's a piece of junk. I've never had that. Yeah. Everybody loves them, and they run forever.
It was the size that was getting me, and you even mentioned a big car. Generally, when people are learning, the less damage you inflict on what's around you, the better for kids.
Well, when you talk about safety, though, that's what he mentioned, too, the airbags, the ability to do that. If you're in a much smaller Corolla and you were into Tahoe, you have a less likely chance, unless you're folding that hood for the whole 4 feet it takes to reach the windshield.
Well, versus on the something Camry. That big, I don't think the Camry's going to make that much of a difference. So.
Well, I actually had a customer wreck one. That's why I used that one as an example.
I mean, I like the idea that there was absolutely no hesitation to recommend that car. On the other hand, my fiance drives a 92 Tercel that she's loved from day one.
It's got 300.
No, she's got a little over 225 on hers.
Okay.
And it's still going strong. You know, you could lift the engine out of that bay with one hand and rebuild it on your own. It's so simple.
And to give a plug to older Camrys, my sister-in-law had one that it started out belonging to another friend of mine who drove it for years and years and years and years and years and years and years. And this was a white one with a beige interior and a manual gearbox. He finally sold it to her when he wasn't using it as much, and her Honda had been wrecked while it was parked by a drunk driver. So she buys this Camry from him, I think 5 years ago or so, and it took a tree falling on it to kill it.
Yeah, they're really tough. And like what you mentioned about that, though, being a manual transmission is for somebody who's young to drive, a teenager. A lot of teenagers these days cannot drive a manual transmission.
Right.
So when we talk about the older cars for that $2,000 budget, you can find, you know, the old, the Ford Focus that you can find in a stick shift for that budget, the Corolla and Civics that you can find in that budget. A lot of them are going to be manual transmission, but the Camry is very popular with automatic. And because it's not an automatic, that if they're going to, you know, drive maybe more aggressively, that you're going to burn it out right away, like you would with the Accord. If you drive a Accord pretty aggressively on that automatic, it tend to not like you as much. But that's why I picked that one as a good first car.
Now, as for the cigar smells, though.
Well, I don't know about that. That's going to have to be finding the right buyer or the seller.
That, or I think that would be a good, I guess that would be a DIY project, probably.
There you go. Just go sit in it for 40 minutes.
Add some cigar smells on your own. All right. I did not ask our trivia for question for the day, so let's quickly cover that, and then we'll move on with the rest of our agenda. In fact, I think we're going to save the rest of these listener questions for the next episode, because they're providing to be really good conversation fodder. So we'll split them up, I think. But in the meantime, our trivia question for the day is, in 1970, Plymouth debuted the 346-pack AAR Cuda. What does AAR stand for? All-American Racer? All-American Roadster? Average Annual Rainfall? Azimuth Apogee Racing?
Oh, my.
I'm going to go with All-American Racer.
Well, hang on to that. So,
wait, what were the first two again?
Okay, the question again is, in 1970, Plymouth debuted the 346-pack AAR Cuda. What does AAR stand for? All-American Racer? All-American Roadster? Average Annual Rainfall, or Azimuth Apogee Racing? So hold on to your answer. Let's just do a couple things off of our agenda, and then we'll go over the answer.
All right.
So moving on from listener questions, someone wrote up on the board, Becca, I think this one's yours, Classic Car Market 2019, hot or not?
Yeah, I came across an article. I kind of referred to it a little bit earlier. they're basically going through and saying what they're seeing trends for in older vehicles. I'm trying to remember. I needed to go through here with my highlighter. They were basing it on Hagerty's information that they were getting, though. I think various either requests for quotes or auctions, things like that. Just what they're seeing now in the generations that, that can't quite afford something newer. They are saying that some of the newer generations are still buying, and I'm going to use air quotes, classic cars, because not all of these are what I would actually call a classic car. Not what would scream into my brain, but but like we mentioned earlier, you know, Toyota's in here, a different generation, yeah. But the MR2 is listed here. But going through really quickly, pardon me, hot 1980 to 1986 Ford Bronco, which if you remember back before I got the Jeep, you remember me trying to get my hands on a Bronco?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
All
yeah.
that I was going through, and it was either ungodly expensive or there was that death trap that I got into. they're ranging the price from $13,000 to $18,000. I'm going to say even more than that. I was seeing things in line with
that sounds low
to me. Yeah, excessively low.
This is a Bronco 1, not a Bronco 2, right?
It's just called the Bronco. Okay. Then
it's
Bronco
it's the big Bronco,
two.
The full size. Right.
The real Bronco. Sorry, right. No offense to Bronco 2 owners out
well,
there.
Well, you have the big Bronco, which is the full-size Bronco you're referring to, and then back in the late 60s and early 70s, you had the little Bronco, which
but it was
still
just the Bronco. Right. It wasn't, yeah. If your top comes off, you're a Bronco. If it doesn't, you're a Bronco too.
Right. So the Broncos, though, that now when I think of the classic market, I've heard them called at car shows, you have little Bronco section and full-size Bronco section. Yeah.
But then you also have the XLT, which is a little bit bigger. I don't know.
I don't know. That's how I told them.
I never found one, so I don't get to go to the Bronco shows. I got a Jeep instead. Okay, so not shoebox Fords. 1949 to 1951, one of their examples, if you don't know what a shoebox Ford is, a 1949 Ford Tudor. So basically the roundish Ford sedan type, if you need to visualize.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently those are not hot. Another hot 1985-1989 Toyota MR2.
Mm-hmm.
$10,500 to $14,000 is what they're saying. They're saying it's high in demand with millennials. And going back to what Ben was talking about earlier, a quote from the article: "The car suspension and handling were designed in cooperation with Lotus."
Oh yeah.
Apparently that this generation of MR2 also appeared in several video games, including Gran Turismo and Forza series. So they're saying that might be part of the popularity.
I definitely agree. Yeah. Definitely agree.
Not on this, and I'm very sorry. I hope Eric's not listening to this episode. 1970-1974 Dodge Challenger, $27,000 to $32,000. Though I find it funny the price ranges on some of these not cars.
I wonder why they're calling them knots. Are these people trying to influence the market so they can buy one cheaply?
I don't know. I think
because I just looked up Ford Tudors, they look pretty cool to me.
Some of these I'm kind of shocked at. Maybe they consider some of them more niche.
If it's marketing for millennials, is I believe that's what you said, right? That this is for the newer generation of classic cars through Hagerty?
Well, I can't remember if it was targeted towards them or because of them, but it definitely sounds like they were looking at a certain age range.
Right. Well, when you're looking at that age range, maybe those older cars appeal to a older market, because when you're talking about millennials, the two cars you've listed that are hot are 80s.
I'm not that old.
Well, I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about the kind of cars that you see being, you know, 80s is now called the classic car.
Right.
That boggles my brain, really. It does.
Oh, and maybe we're just old.
Yeah.
Well, a millennial generation, when they were little tiny kids, the things we think of as classic cars were already, you know, classics people were looking for.
Exactly.
Right.
Right.
That MR2 was what, you know, they saw on the way to kindergarten and went, ooh.
Right. That's right.
Speaking of which, I saw a Fiero on the road the other day. I had to sit there and laugh. Okay, I'm just going to finish this up.
We're running out of time, so yes.
Hot, 2000 to 2006 BMW M3. I'm sure Ronnie would like to comment. They're showing 28 to 34,000 price range. This one, the way they phrase it, it definitely makes me think that they're targeting certain groups, though. Not mid-year Corvettes. And I think it was odd to phrase it that way. They are referring to the 1963 to 1967 Corvette. The price range they are showing is $85,000 to $95,000. One of the reasons they're citing that was is just price on that.
Yeah.
1997 to 2004, which again is why I'm having a hard time seeing classic. I know how old 97 is. I'm not, you know.
Just say collector car then. It's a collector car.
97 to 2004 Porsche Boxster. 13,800 to 17,200, and I have my own comment.
Is that a hot or a nut?
That is a hot.
Okay, yeah.
I still see a frog squatting down to take a dump on the ground every time I see one. It does.
Yeah, yeah.
It's got the humps like the legs and a.
I reached that conclusion awesome. Completely independently myself. Yeah,
that's awesome.
That is fantastic.
But it's got some good things going for it, you know, performance wise, and you know.
My Mustang beat one when she was still stock. Yeah. So I'm not impressed by the frog British. So. Moving rapidly along, not Tri-5 Chevys. So we're looking at the mid-50s. They're talking about 55 to 57. An example was the 57 Chevy Bel Air, which, I'm sorry, if you had to pick a representative for the entire classic car, what is wrong with the Bel Air?
I think the Bel Air is great, but I think the reason it's probably not on that list is something that people are going to search after is because of its price point and now how rare that car is becoming.
It's become super iconic.
I feel like it's been all bought out. That all the ones that were left in fields that were half decent have all been bought. I think that's what's happening with those.
I really wish that I had printed out that article. I found this just treasure trove of auto stuff happening about a week ago. There was a more recent barn find. Now I'm trying to even remember what state it was in, and a lot of them need tons of repair. But, you know, old GTOs, old Mustangs, obviously, but then there were, you know, Comets, and they had a Fury in there. I would love to have gotten a Fury. But
when you talk about that much work, though, the people who are in that age bracket, when they start talking about, I'm going to have this in my garage, I'm going to have to do all this body work, and then is it even going to run? Can I find parts for it? And they don't know the answers to those questions. So then maybe it doesn't appeal to them as much as the 80s MR2 would, that they know for a fact they can get parts, they can buy a running one, these kind of things.
Right. Word one, welding. Word two, fabrication.
All right, let's wrap this up.
Yeah. Let me go hot. 2004. 2007 Subaru Impreza WRX STI.
Oh, yeah.
25.7 to 33.7. Not. You'll like their answer on this, I'm sure. Not Ferrari. For the price range, dollar sign, if you have to ask, ...
Right.
Yeah.
Of course.
So, yeah. So a lot of this, I have a hard time seeing, you know, like that last one, 04 to 07 Subaru, I have a hard time putting the label classic on that.
Yeah, right? I don't know why anyone would want to call that one a classic. That just doesn't
seem like it's kind of become one already. It's really got a following. It's kind of in, by itself in a class.
But does a car with a cult following, is that automatically a classic?
No. Well, I'm sorry. At one point, these words had actual meaning. So if you were vintage, you were at least 20 years old. If you were antique, you were at least 25.
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't there be an age range on this label?
Well, no, because the textbook definition of classic is representative of a class.
Okay.
There you go.
It's the type that comes to mind when you think of a certain range of something.
Sure.
You know, it's, yeah.
All right. The answer to our trivia question, in 1970, Plymouth debuted the 340 six-pack AAR CUDA. What does AAR stand for? Azimuth Apogee Racing, Average Annual Rainfall, All-American Roadster, or All-American Racer?
And, you know, Eric's going to kick my butt if I can't get that.
I'm going with All-American Roadster, just to guess.
Roadster?
Yeah.
Okay. Ben?
You know, on the one hand, I want to go with All-American Racer, but on the other hand, that Azimuth Apogee, something about that sticks out.
Right?
You know, like somebody who may have been involved in the project or something.
So Azimuth Apogee Racing.
Right, that was crossing my mind, but I think I'm just going to have to stick with the Roadster just because there are other Roadster names in the Dodge lineup back then.
Roadster, so Becca says Roadster as well. Okay, the answer is All-American Racers. The name of Dan Gurney's racing enterprise. Plymouth collaborated with Gurney/AAR in 1970 to race the AAR CUDA in the SCCA Trans Am series. So it's It's the name of Dan Gurney's making, All-American Racer.
I'm sorry, Eric.
There you have it. All right. On that note, we're going to wrap this episode and pick it up again in the next episode. This has been The Thing About Cars, recording, as always, in Strongbox West in Atlanta, Georgia. We're going to be at car shows. You've heard us talk about Italian Car Day on March 2? There's a C5 car show happening at the Brookhaven Cherry Blossom Festival on March 30th. And the big one we're all looking forward to is the Summit Racing Equipment Motorama at the Atlanta Motor Speedway on April 27 and 28. You'll definitely find us there. That being said, thanks for all your help and your support. Please always send us your criticisms and your comments. You can find us at thethingaboutcars.com or on Facebook. Just search for The Thing About Cars. And we will look forward to seeing you next time. Be safe out there.
Bye.
See ya.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.